from KQED.
Good morning. This is the California Report podcast. I'm Penny Nelson. Well, frustrated by inaction over immigration reform and addressing the plight of Dreamers, those young people brought to the U.S. illegally as kids, moderate House Republicans and Democrats tried to circumvent the Republican leadership. They gathered enough lawmaker signatures for the discharge petition. You've likely heard about that in the news, a petition that would have forced a vote on four immigration bills. But the maneuver failed this week. So what's next? We called Los Angeles area Democratic Congresswoman Nanette Diaz Barragan, a supporter of the discharge petition, to find out. And Barragan comes from a Mexican immigrant family, and for her, the debate is personal.
Oh, yes. No, I have a DACA recipient who his life is on the line as well, but have family who do live in the shadows, and it is not easy. My district also is 70% Latino, and we have people call us day in and day out, worried and concerned about their future.
We also called California Republican Jeff Denham, Steve Knight, and David Valdeo. All supported the bipartisan petition, but none were available to speak with us. Supervisor London Breed is the apparent winner of a tight election against former state senator Mark Leno in the San Francisco mayor's race. Leno conceded yesterday. Breed, who was raised in San Francisco public housing, will be the first black woman to lead the city. She served as acting mayor following the sudden death of Mayor Ed Lee last December, but was removed by the Board of Supervisors weeks later. KQED's Marisa Lagos joins us to fill in the picture. So, Marisa, remind us, why was she ousted?
I mean, in one word, politics. It looked like she was going to run for the office, and I think her political foes on the board didn't want to give her that leg up, and so they installed Mark Farrell and created what they saw as more of an open race.
What will it mean for San Francisco to have London Breed at the wheel? Where are her passions focused?
Well, you mentioned she's the first African-American woman to lead this city. She's also the first person to come out of the city's public housing complexes to accede to the mayor's office. And so I think we'll see a big focus on housing and homelessness, which is really, you know, top of mind for most San Franciscans. When I covered her at City Hall, she was very focused on emergency response times and was very critical of the fire department. So I'll be interested to see if she replaces folks like Fire Chief Joanne Hayes White. And really, whether she keeps a lot of the department heads that have been in City Hall for many years and ascended to their roles under Mayor Ed Lee.
And when is she expected to step into her new role as mayor?
It'll be a couple weeks. The Department of Elections needs to finish counting, and then they'll send the results to the Board of Supervisors to be certified, and then they would be able to swear her in after that vote occurs.
All right. Thanks, Marisa.
My pleasure, Penny.
Marisa Lagos is a KQED reporter with our politics and government desk. Heading across the bridge, Oakland Mayor Libby Schaaf says new emails about an immigration raid in the Bay Area this winter could play an important role in any legal action the U.S. Justice Department might take against her. The emails obtained by the Bay Area News Group show federal immigration agents were pleased the raids apprehended more people than expected. Schaaf says if she got information about another ICE action, she would do the same thing.
I'm here to protect my city. I'm here to advance public safety. And many law enforcement professionals will tell you that it is crucial in a city like Oakland that is so full of fabulous immigrant families that they need to feel protected.
President Trump has called for an obstruction of justice investigation of Schaaf, but she says she hasn't heard from the Justice Department. So yesterday we told you about the ballot measure going before voters in November that would split California into three states. KQED's Guy Marzorati reports that the backers of Cal 3 need to look back 200 years for an example of success.
The last time a state was carved out of another state was West Virginia in 1863. But that doesn't really count because Virginia had already seceded from the Union. So let's go further back to the early 19th century when residents of Maine wanted to split from Massachusetts and the state didn't mind letting them go.
And that culminated very quickly in the 1810s to a successful vote for statehood.
That's Colin Woodard, who wrote A History of Early Maine. If this effort to split up California is approved statewide, residents in some of the newly created states might not want it. University of Illinois Law Dean Vikram Amar says that raises a constitutional issue.
Arguably, the legislative body of each of those new states, they might have to weigh in as well.
That's just one legal issue that the measure faces, but let's say it does advance to the U.S. Congress, where the new states would have to be approved. Colin Woodard says national politics worked out for Maine in 1820, when the state's entrance into the Union as a free state balanced the creation of slave state Missouri.
Maine presented a solution to a problem on the federal stage, whereas California splitting the three states wouldn't as much.
Today, Republicans could be horrified by the possibility of having four new senators from California, and Democrats may not want to jeopardize the 55 electoral votes they reliably get from the Golden State. For the California Report, I'm Guy Marzorati.
On to housing for those without homes. City officials in Orange County met yesterday to tell federal judge David O. Carter where they'll locate three new homeless shelter sites. Here's KQED's Michelle Wiley.
Anaheim, Santa Ana, Huntington Beach. Those are the three locations that Orange County officials proposed to Judge Carter in an open session of court on Wednesday. Shelters would be built in each city that would house up to 700 people. But where exactly will the sites go? That part is being kept quiet. In a statement, Chairman of the Orange County Board of Supervisors, Andrew Doe, says there's no point in getting the entire county worked up unnecessarily until all parties have completed their due diligence, meaning they'll assess the sites for suitability and cost before giving out the address. Doe also proposed a plan to build 2,700 units of permanent supportive housing during the hearing. While he says they'll be spread across the county, no specific sites were named in that proposal either. Orange County officials now have until July 16th to craft a plan of action before some of the temporary shelters close their doors. For the California Report, I'm Michelle Wiley.
So a series of extraordinary and some say wacky weather events last year has clouded Lake Tahoe's legendary clarity. A report released yesterday says 2017 was the lake's murkiest year ever recorded. KQED science editor Craig Miller has the story.
First, an epic five-year drought, then record amounts of rain and snow. Jeffrey Schlatto, who heads the Tahoe Environmental Research Center, says the two made for a nasty 1-2 punch at Tahoe.
The drought led lots of sediment build up in the streams over that five-year period, and then finally this event, this really extreme winter, washed it all into the lake, literally in that one year.
At least 12 times more sediment than in recent years. Schlatto says the lake is already starting to recover, but warns that extreme weather patterns like the ones that caused last year's plunge in clarity are likely to happen more often as the climate changes. It may tarnish Tahoe's reputation as a jewel-like presence in the Sierra.
For the California Report, I'm Craig Miller.
Big Sur's Highway 1 is set to reopen sooner than expected. Counted as part of the wacky weather, but the road was just south of Gorda and wiped out by a massive landslide last year. KAZU's Krista Amundson reports.
Caltrans moved up the date to open this new section of Highway 1 from mid-September to late July. A relatively mild winter meant little rain, and that's been good for construction crews who are building a quarter mile of new roadway on top of the slide. Susanna Cruz is a Caltrans spokesperson.
So it allowed us to really make a lot of progress and our crews to be vigilant.
It's been more than a year since Highway 1 has been closed right near the border of Monterey and San Luis Obispo counties. That has kept tourists from completing the scenic drive through on the highway. Caltrans has active signs warning of the closure. Still, Cruz says every day people drive up to the roadblocks on the north and south.
They're disappointed they can't make it all the way through, but there's still a lot to see. Once this opens, then it will be the beautiful trek that people like going, you know, the San Francisco to L.A. or San Diego trek.
If Highway 1 opens as planned at the end of July, roadwork and intermittent closures will still continue for several months. For the California Report, I'm Krista Almanzon in Monterey.
Now that CAL FIRE investigators are starting to finger PG&E in a series of fires that swept through Northern California last fall, killing 44 people and destroying thousands of homes, a simmering battle over who should pay for the billions of dollars in damages caused by those fires is heating up. Marisa Lagos from KQED's California Politics and Government Desk spoke with KQED's Polly Stryker about what changes to state law the utility is pushing and who's fighting back.
So, Marisa, PG&E executives have been pretty vocal about their problems with the way state laws stand right now in terms of who pays for damage after wildfires. What are they saying?
Well, they're really arguing that, things are changing, that with climate change and drought, the game has changed, and that, you know, they're investing in better technology and working to sort of get ahead of these things, these types of disasters, but that if they're held on the hook financially for every single thing that occurs that might also have, you know, something to do with the conditions in California, that they won't survive financially. And we are talking about a lot of money. State estimates are showing that the damages from the wildfires in Wine Country alone could be between $11 and $14 billion, and PG&E only has about $850 million of liability insurance. So they've been out there publicly pushing for a change to a legal principle in California known as inverse condemnation. And that's a law that basically says that since public utilities like PG&E get to use private and public land for their equipment and lines, that if that equipment then damages somebody's property that it's on, they're liable, even if they did everything right, even if all, you know, they followed all the state laws in the past.
Is there legislation that could change that?
There is not legislation on that yet. There's a different bill that has also drawn some criticism. This is Senate Bill 1088. It was written by labor unions affiliated with utilities customers, and it would basically require utilities to work with state regulators to create a safety plan that would be approved by the California Public Utility Commission, and ostensibly anything in that plan would be paid for by customers, by ratepayers. Sounds, you know, pretty good on its surface, right?
Yeah, but there's a catch. Right.
Yeah, so critics say that this bill would basically absolve shareholders of having to pay fines. The bill's being carried by Senator Bill Dodd, who represents a lot of the areas affected by these fires. I just sat down with him, and he's saying, look, this is not an effort to pass on any cost, but he really feels like in the past there hasn't been a robust enough effort sort of ahead of a disaster to make sure that the safety plans are being followed and laid out and reviewed by the CPUC often enough. And he points out that this wouldn't prevent someone from suing PG&E in court, for example.
That's the California Report's Polly Stryker talking with KQED reporter Marisa Lagos.
Support for the California Report comes from the James Irvine Foundation, expanding economic and political opportunity for Californians who are working but struggling with poverty. More at irvine.org. CCRM. Using today's technology and care, CCRM physicians help people achieve fertility goals and build families. Now open in Menlo Park. Learn more at ccrmivf.com/San Francisco. And Eric and Wendy Schmidt, whose Fund for Strategic Innovation supports transformative ideas that benefit humanity while protecting the natural world, recognizing through science the interdependence of all living systems.
And that's the California Report for Thursday, June 14th, a production of KQED Public Radio. I'm Penny Nelson, and I hope you have a great day.